This is a conversation with Clarence Matthews. We are at his home at 8702 Lynn Hall Court in Louisville, Kentucky. It is May 10th, 2000. My name is Ethel White. If we could, Mr. Matthews, I would like to start with some biographical material from you, starting with your birth and just sketch in a few details.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was born in Birmingham, Alabama, January 10th, 1929. And I always tease people, say I have a kinship with Martin Luther King because he was born about 120 miles east 5 days later in 1929 in Atlanta, Georgia. And I didn't stay around in Birmingham too long. As you might guess, as a Depression baby, families usually moved around quite a bit during those years. And we came to Louisville and stayed here briefly. And my mother was young, and she had two other children. Both are older. My sister is about a year and a half older than I am. She's in Chicago. She's a retired social worker. And my brother, who's here, he's a retired Army officer. He just moved back here after, not retired, he's a non-commissioned officer. And he came back about 5 or 6 years ago. And but I left and went with an older sister of my mother's and went to Detroit. And we had a brief stopover in West Virginia, come to think of it, because he worked in, my uncle worked in a coal mine briefly, still searching for work. And we finally moved on to Detroit. And I guess I was about, maybe about 2 years old when we arrived in Detroit. And that's where I was reared. Went through school. And I guess, elementary school and intermediate school, we call there, was the junior high, middle school here, and high school. Went on to a junior college and to Wayne University, which is now Wayne State University. And then I came here in 1956 at the urging of my mother. I thought it was going to be a brief visit. But when I came down, she always wanted me to stay, because actually when I left with my aunt, we didn't see each other that often, maybe about once every 3 or 4 years, something like that. So anyway, she wanted me to stay, so when I came down, she knew Frank Stanley, Sr., who was publisher of the Thunder, and she told him that I had a background in journalism, and would I be interested, would he be interested in talking with me about a job there? And I didn't know that, but, and then he called me, and I went up there, and he hired me just after one interview, and so I stayed.
Can I just interrupt you mm-hmm. briefly enough to say, or to ask, did you have a background in journalism?
Yeah, just school, that's all, and I did some freelance articles, you know, for different things, magazines and a newspaper. Michigan Chronicle, which is a black-oriented newspaper. It was just a small article for that.
Okay. Were there any opportunities in the late 1950s for black journalists other than in black publications?
No, there wasn't. There's a guy that you could count black journalists working for majority newspapers, daily newspapers, on his hand, maybe just with three fingers. There was a guy by the name of Ted Poston from Kentucky that started working for the New York Post, I think, around 1937.
Poston?
Mm-hmm. P-O-S-T-O-N. And Ted, his first name. He may have been from Paducah, I'm not sure, but he's from Kentucky. And another guy by the name of Orrin Evans, who started, I think he spelled his first name O-R-R-I-N, Evans the usual way, E-B-A-N-S. He started working maybe about a year after that for the Philadelphia Inquirer. And those were the only two guys for years that were working for daily newspapers in large cities. And then in the 50s, it was still only those two guys. The big movement came after, I guess, doing in the middle of the civil rights era, and in 1961, 2, 3, 4, 5, along in there, that's when the majority of black reporters started working for daily newspapers. But before then, Nash says no.
Okay.
Well, yeah, I think the Courier must have hired his first black reporter maybe in 1966. I think it was a fellow named James Osbrook.
Oh.
Yeah, that's D-I-O-O-K. I think he stayed for about a couple of years, and he was married to Eleanor Young, Willie Young's sister. They didn't stay together that long. But anyway, he moved back to Kansas. I think that's where he was from. And then he became a journalism professor. I think it was University of Kansas. And the next one after he left was a fellow named Bill Drummond came to the Courier. And that must have been about 67. No, 66 maybe, because it was a few months before I came to the Courier. I came to the Courier in 1967 in May. I mean, to the Times, I'm sorry, Louisville Times. And before that, the Times had never had a full-time black reporter before then. So at that time, I guess it was Osbrook and Bill Drummond and myself. I guess we were the first three. I was the first on the Times, and those two were the first on the Courier. And then after that, they had quite a few. Charlene Hunter came as an intern on the Times, but she wasn't a full-time staffer before I got there, about a year before I came.
Okay. Well, back to Frank Stanley.
Mm-hmm.
You were hired then to work for the Louisville Defender,
right,
in 1956?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Immediately went out to cover the election campaign. John Sherman Cooper and Thurston Moore were both running for the Senate at the same time, and they both won in 56.
Was there anything, well, let's see, were there any civil rights overtones at all to those campaigns? Were there any issues that figured in?
No, not particularly. It was an undercurrent there because of, you know, Montgomery bus boycott had just ended, I think, and civil rights was on everyone's mind, but it wasn't a big, big issue, if you know what I mean. Although, my job was to ask the candidates, you know, how they stood on certain things and et cetera, et cetera.
What do you remember about that?
Well, I remember they were responsive, both Morton and Cooper. And Cooper especially, as you probably can remember, was a grand gentleman and a great guy. And I've never been a Republican, I'm a Democrat. But, he was a great, great guy. He was sincere, you know, and he... But he was a politician. People don't remember that, though. But I think he was a very skilled politician.
So he couldn't really say too much?
That's right.
So was your coverage of the Cooper and the Morton campaigns, was that pretty time-consuming? Was that mostly what you did for that first
year? Yeah, I just followed them around the state, yeah. And at those times, public accommodations law had not been passed, and so we had to stay in private homes in these different little towns. And but I didn't have any trouble, you know, going and covering them in different places, and et cetera.
Well, how did you find the private homes to stay in? What was your pipeline?
Frank Stanley knew a lot of people around the state, and he just
now this was Frank Stanley, Senior?
Right. He just gave me their names, and when I got there, they had a place for me.
So you never encountered any kind of hostility or racism or in those travels because you there was no opportunity, essentially.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
Yeah.
And as a reporter, you had no problem?
No. Mm-mm. No, the only time we, this had nothing to do with the campaign, but we used to go out and some people forget this, but most black reporters that during this early part of the civil rights era used to go out and test lunch counters even before the students did in North Carolina. They used to go out just, you write a story, you go in, because I remember going in the old Taylor's, I guess, at 4th and, I think it was 4th and Chestnut. And setting down, and then of course they refuse you, you go back and you write a story, about the refusal.
And this was before the student sit-ins?
Yeah, black reporters used to do that all over. I remember in St. Louis they were doing it, and they may have done it in Nashville, I'm not sure. But in Birmingham, I'm not sure. I know they did it in St. Louis, and I did it here. And
alone?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You just go in with a photographer, maybe lingering around somewhere and take your picture, while you while you're sitting at the counter or something. But there was no, it wasn't a bad incident. It just didn't serve me. That's all.
You would sit down and ask for?
Yeah, ask for service. Yeah.
For service, and what would they say?
They say, "Well, we don't serve Negroes here."
And you would say, "Okay," and you'd leave, and then you go write the article.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it wasn't any confrontation, because I wasn't being paid enough for that. I had to go to jail.
Did Frank Stanley or somebody else at the Defender ask you to do this, or was this something you did on your own?
Well, I guess it was a combination of things, and the guy that was, I don't know whether Frank was involved with it or not. I'm kind of hazy, but I know the guy that was managing editor at the time, but it was Nathaniel Tillman. We talked about it, and we decided to do it. Yeah, but that was quite unusual. I think they did it at Michigan Chronicle, too, in Detroit. And people don't realize that northern cities were segregated also. And growing up, I remember the Stouffer's, for example, in Washington. Seems kind of ridiculous now since Detroit is majority, black city, but the Stouffer's and all the hotels on Washington Boulevard, which is sort of the main fashionable street, in Detroit, and just one block west of Woodward Avenue, which was the main drag, and it had, all the big stores and whatnot, and nice hotels and all that sort of thing. But no, they would not serve black folks in those hotels or even Stouffer's at that time. Although Michigan had a civil rights law, I had one on the books since 1936. A fellow named Charles Diggs, who was a state senator and father of the late Congressman Charles Diggs, Sr., Jr., had introduced it, and it was passed in 1936, but they still wouldn't do it. They risked going to court.
I'm going to put this on pause for just a second. This mm-hmm. needle isn't bouncing the way I want it to, and I'm going to move this a little closer to
okay.
you. Did you ever test it around the state of Kentucky other than in Louisville?
No.
Just in Louisville and
in
Detroit?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Did you, from your travels around the state, did you get any sense, other than what you just sort of knew anyway, mm-hmm. did you get any sense from people about whether anything at all was happening in the civil rights line, or what, or attitudes, hostilities, good stuff?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, in some cities, like Hopkinsville, there'd always been, black involvement in politics and all that sort of thing. And Hopkinsville was a pretty progressive town. You had black people involved in running the city. I think they had a black councilman. I don't know whether the councilman or alderman that they had at that time. I remember people like Lewis McHenry Sr., who was officer in NAACP locally and in the state, was very prominent there. And it had a fairly good size black middle class community in Hopkinsville, as I recall at that time. And We didn't do too much in northern Kentucky because it was pretty far afield, and the Cincinnati Herald sort of covered, which is another black newspaper, sort of covered northern Kentucky area, you know, what it was doing with black folks up that way. But there wasn't that much activity, as I recall. Most of the civil rights activity, you know, was emanating out of Louisville at that time.
All right, let's go back to Louisville, and you covered the two senatorial campaigns in 1956, mm-hmm. and what was your next assignment, or what kinds of things did you then get into, to put it that way?
Yeah, well, we did a lot of feature stories, and I remember one we used to do called People You Should Know, in which we profiled prominent black folks in the community, and also some not so prominent, like people involved in, you know, child care or something like that, or doing something for the community. Somebody that, like Charlie Anderson, for example, who was the first black legislator since Reconstruction, and things like that, you know, profiling people like that. And then I do remember doing a series on, in fact, I was thinking about doing it for the Black Journal magazine, maybe, but a series on what was going on with black folks in smaller Kentucky communities, and we called it Kentucky Neighbors, in which I went around to all sorts of cities, you know, like even went to Lebanon, as I recall, and because the interest there was because Lebanon at that time, I think, had was sort of an entertainment, for some reason, the entertainment capital of central Kentucky. And although it had a strong Catholic presence up there, as they do now in central Kentucky. And but big bands used to come into a little club, I wish I could remember the name of it, but don't recall, but big bands and well-known national entertainers used to come to Lebanon mm-hmm. and entertain. Then we did a story on Springfield and, of course, down in Hopkinsville and Richmond, Kentucky, and Lexington, and places like that. So it's sort of interesting because I got a chance to meet a lot of people, you know, going around and talking to them in different parts of the state. Even went down to Paducah, which is a long drive. You didn't have an interstate at that time. I think you had to take US 60, and which is just snakes all the way down along the river, you know, down to western Kentucky. But it was interesting. And then, you know, after that, just did a lot of stories that came up, especially after the civil rights movement started. There was a lot of civil rights stories. And the demonstration started in 1960 or 61. Because I remember, I think it was, some of the early demonstrations were at the old Kaufman Strauss store, and then the drug stores, and then moved on to, I guess it was Woolworth, used to be in the middle of the block between 4th Street between Chestnut and Broadway, used to be there. Was it Woolworth or was it Cresby's? Yeah, I think it was Woolworth's now. And of course, as I said, the Taylor drugstore and Blue Boar, and I think it used to be the old Coopies there on 5th Street, too. I think those demonstrations were there. Okay, I remember one of the better stories that we had, sort of funny story, was in the Blue Boar when Gene Johnson, the owner at the time, when the demonstrations led by Frank Stanley Jr. were outside, demonstrators outside picketing, and they were asking for admission, and he says, well, you know, we just can't serve Negroes in here, and so forth, and so on.
This was Gene Johnson.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And then I think somebody said, it may have been Frank, or somebody said, well, you do serve Negroes. You got two or three of them sitting in there. And there were there was some, you know, very fair black folks. Like May Street Kid was one of them. He had a former representative, and Lottie Steele, the wife of the former executive director of the Urban League, Charlie Steele, she was there. And the other one may have been Jane Hankins, I'm not sure. I'm not sure about her, but I think it was her. And she was the wife of the guy that, I forget his first name. His last name was Hankins, so he was president of Mammoth Life Insurance Company. But anyway, they were just sitting in there, and he was, you know, he was just...
And Johnson didn't know?
No, he didn't know, no. No, see, they were very, you know, very fair, and he did know.
Was there any evidence that he might have been struck by the ridiculousness of all this?
I don't think so. If it did, he didn't let on. It was sort of funny, you know, but those are the kind of things that, as you said, it points out the absurdities of the whole thing, you know.
Now, were you there at the time that this was happening?
Yeah,
and you then reported this to your, or in your newspaper?
Yeah, in the story, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, can we go back to the beginnings of this, 1960-61, mm-hmm. and do you remember the first demonstration that, or was there something preliminary to that that you were reporting on?
I don't know. It seems like it all happened a little fast, you know, when they started. It was, I remember Raul Cunningham, he used to be active in political circles around here. I think he still is. I think he's up at Frankfort doing something, maybe. But I remember it was really student driven, and then Frank Stanley Jr. was involved, got involved, and Reverend Hodge, and Bishop C. Eubank Tucker, who was the African Methodist Episcopal Zion bishop, and a lawyer, became involved.
Now these were not students.
Oh, no.
So
no.
You said it was student-driven. So
yeah, it was student-driven, and the adults sort of came on, you know, to give guidance, so to speak, and they added a little punch, I guess, to it. And Frank was quite young. He could identify, you know, closely with the young folks. Mm-hmm. And they stayed together through all the demonstrations. In fact, most of the young people went to the 1963 march on Washington. Where Martin Luther King spoke, mm-hmm. I'm trying to think. I see a lot of them around today, and some of them, I know one was Ben Chove's daughter, as I recall, retired circuit court judge, his daughter, who, she was a principal in the county school system. I don't know what she does now. I think she's, she may be in some sort of administrative position. I remember she was there and some of her young friends. I'm trying to think of some of the others. Anyways, there's quite a cadre of young folks, you know, that stayed together through the demonstrations and all of that. And there was, you know, there's quite a few, you know, white folks around, like Lukey Ward, Lucretia Ward, and Mike Ward's mother, mm-hmm. who died, a couple of years ago, I guess it was. And of course her husband, and
Jasper.
Remember the late Charles Hammond too. I don't know whether you knew him or not. He was quite involved. And Thomas Hogan too.
Who's this?
Tom Hogan. He's a lawyer. And I guess he's got a family.
Oh, he was involved in the school. Did you say school busing?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and. He's got a brother, a cousin that's a priest. I think he has two or three priests in his family, some of the Hogans. And also, I can't think of his name, lawyer. I see his face, but I'm trying to... Oh, Taylor, yeah, Dan Taylor was involved, too, another lawyer. Yeah, getting back to the demonstration, yeah, this... It sort of seems like everything was happening all at once, but I'm not sure where it originally started at. But it seemed like to me the demonstrations at Kaufman's was high on the list, and also at Stewart's too, in that dining room they used to have up there on the fifth or sixth floor, somewhere along there. And the Blue Boar was probably, I think the Blue Boar came later, and some of the movie houses came maybe a little bit later. But I think Kaufman's and maybe Stewart's and probably Taylor and Woolworth are probably some of the first, I think.
Well, what can you, I mean, you were a reporter out on the streets while mm-hmm. these things were going on. What do you remember about, I mean, what did you see? What did it look like? Mm-hmm. I mean, were there, you know, what did it look like?
Yeah, well, you know, they used to gather at Quinn Chapel. You know, a lot of the kids used to come down from Central, so you had, what, about two blocks from 11th Street down to 9th Street, and they usually started out with a rally, you know, and everybody. And the enthusiasm of the kids was really incredible. They really were gung-ho on all of that. And then, you know, they'd get together and they'd hear from some of the speakers, like Frank Stanley Jr. And Reverend Sampson, too. He used to be at Mount Lebanon a long time ago. He's in Detroit now, pastoring a church. But he was really an eloquent speaker that could really just, you know, just get people going, inspire people to go out and do things. And then they would, you know, march, and it was really a long line, you know, and they would clap and march and go to these sites. It was a lot of folks, because they used to drop off, you know, people maybe at that Russian at Fifth and Chestnut, and then another group would go to Blue Boar, another group would go someplace else, another group would, and in many instances, I mean, about, you know, in any one time, there's so many kids that you have maybe about five or six different spots where they would be.
So that's the reason. And how many people do you think were at each spot, roughly?
I don't know. I remember that from time to time, the police would arrest as many as 300 or so, you know, a day. So it must have been, you know, maybe about 60 or 70 people at each site sometime. And it was just, they were really gung-ho, and, you know, and they used to, you know, sit down at these sites, and, you know, and they'd just pick them up and take them away and arrest them, and many of them several times, you know.
Do you remember what, if there was any one thing that sparked the demonstrations here in the beginning? Was it something that happened here? Was it looking around the country to see what else was going on?
I think one of the things that may have started, as I recall, there was a push for a public accommodations law, and the city had refused to enact one, and then either at about that time, or just before that time, when they started demonstrations. I think they started demonstrations before, and then came the push for a public accommodations law. And it's sort of a combination of things, because actually the demonstrations that started with the students down in North Carolina, I think maybe in 60 or 61. And then, of course, Martin Luther King in 55 at the Montgomery bus boycott. But that was sort of, you know, had sort of died out, but they did have the Freedom Rides, you know, right after that, in the late 50s and early 60s. And so that was sort of coming together. It was something that was conscious on everybody's mind. And then when it started out in North Carolina with the sit-ins, and that sort of swept the country, including Louisville. So it was a combination of, you know, some things that were happening here and some things that were happening elsewhere, you know, that inspired it. But, you know, civil rights and was, you know, just about it. You know, it started gathering a little steam about that time. You know. And then Martin Luther King had been here and had fired up people, so to speak.
What do you remember? Well, Martin Luther King came, when you say here, do you mean Louisville, or do you mean when he came to Frankfort?
Well, when he came to Frankfort, and the mayor spoke at the commencement of Frankfort. I'm forgetting when that was. It may have been in 57, 58, somewhere along in there. And I forget when he was here, but I remember the Alpha Phi Alpha fraternity had honored him with something. I think Frank Stanley Sr. had been president at one time. I don't know whether it was during that period or not when they honored him. And I think he persuaded him to come here for something or another. I'm kind of hazy on that. Mm-hmm. But I do remember he was, in fact, he was here several times, because D.E. King used to be pastor of Zion Church, no relation, had been a friend. And then A.D. Williams King, Martin Luther King's brother, had succeeded D.E. King when he was here, in and out, before he was killed in 68.
Did you ever see King yourself?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm.
What struck you about him?
Well, I guess it's his demeanor. He always seemed calm, you know. He never was excited about anything. And the eloquence of the man. I guess he was a brilliant and very smart man, and, you know, and he had
charisma. You know, he wasn't, if you looked at him, he wasn't, might say, a handsome man or anything of that sort, but he did have a presence, you know, about him, and he must have, I don't know, but he had such a great command of scriptures and a way of tying scripture in with whatever was happening at that time, you know. And it was, he was a remarkable guy.
Did you ever actually meet him?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, his brother introduced me to him.
Was he?
A.D. Williams King.
Was he different up close than when he was making a speech?
No, I don't think so. He just seemed like a down-to-earth guy. You know, mm-hmm. Likeable guy. He laughed easily. You know, he was a nice guy. Yeah.
And do you think he made a difference to the demonstrations here, to the way things went?
Oh, yeah, because people, he was like a Pied Piper, you know, he mentioned Martin Luther King's name and everybody came, you know, black and white. And for one thing, he, as I said before, he's sort of a charismatic kind of guy, and not because of his appearance, but because of what he says and how he can connect things and you know, and relate them to whatever problems or whatever situation they may be facing.
So you think he effectively spurred people on to,
oh, yeah,
to
yeah.
continue this work?
Yeah, not only here, but, you know, everywhere he went. Mm-hmm. And he was here for, you know, his, as I said earlier, several times. You may remember he came for the open housing demonstrations two or three times. And I guess the most worrisome time for people was, I guess, back in 66 when he hinted that they might, seems like history repeats itself. It seems like he hinted that they would have a demonstration at Churchill Downs on Derby Day. History repeats itself, it seems. I don't think he ever had any intention of having a demonstration on Derby Day. But there was an incident, some people ran onto the track. I don't know whether that year or the year afterwards. Hmm. But it was.
Well, you mentioned roughly 300 arrests a day.
Mm-hmm.
What do you remember? What were the people arrested for? How violent were these demonstrations getting?
Oh, they weren't violent at all. They were just arrested for things like disorderly conduct, trespassing, you know, something of that sort. No, there was never any violence.
And never any real fear of it? Or at least any rational fear of it?
I don't think so. So most of the people involved were young, and when you're young, you don't have any any fear of anything like that.
Did you interview any of the young people?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
What did they have to say about why they were doing what they were doing, or?
Oh, the usual thing that people might expect is that they felt like, you know, accommodations should be open to all. If they're open to the public, should be open to all the public. You know, things, I don't know, I don't recall their exact words, but that's about what it amounted to.
But nothing really stands out that was unusual about any of these interviews.
Yeah. No.
Did you ever talk to the police?
No, sure didn't. Mm-hmm. No. If I talked to them, I may have asked them what they were being, you know, charged with, and then they told me disorderly conduct or trespassing or something like that. But no, nothing. I'm trying to think. I think that's all. Just, what they're being charged with.
Did you talk to any of the black or the white leadership?
Well, the black leadership was, of course, you know, for it. And I think the mayor at the time didn't have any comment, as I recall. But I forgot, because I remember there was sort of a, I don't know, was it Bruce Hoblitzel was mayor?
Mm-hmm.
I forgot
That's
which right. one. It may have been Bruce Hoblitzel. And he didn't have much to say, at least not to me or the defender. And I've forgotten what he may have said to people at the Courier or the Times at the time. But, no.
Speaking of the Courier Journal and the Times, I was also, you're still at the Defender here
right.
in the time
mm-hmm.
that we're talking, and did you or anyone else at the Defender have any communication with people at the Courier Journal or the Times? Was there ever any not so much coordination as, I guess, communication among the white and black press.
Some of the reporters, especially Paul Janis, I don't know whether you remember him, but he was a guy that I talked to frequently, and Bill Woolsey was another one, who died a couple of years ago. And
what would you talk about?
Civil rights and things, how things going on in general. Of course, Bill Woolsey was the guy that had always been active. Actually, not, because I don't think he was covering civil rights or anything of that sort, but he was a strong supporter, you know, of civil rights. And in fact, he's come down to Joe's Palm Room on 13th Street, and as 13th in the magazine at that time, years ago, was sort of a gathering spot for everybody, you know, politicians and et cetera, et cetera.
Was there ever any plan that would entail sending coordination among white and black reporters to help each other?
No.
In other words, to send each other into areas that were less comfortable or anything like that? No. None of that.
No.
What?
I said no.
Why do you say it that way?
No, because we wouldn't do that ordinarily. That's sort of like almost conspiring. You know, everybody was just off on their own. You know, you just do what you had to do. Let the chips fall where they may, so to speak.
All right, and you, I have my list here. Let's see. You left the Louisville Defender, and then you came back.
Yeah, I went to WLOU.
WLOU.
Left the Defender in 1960.
60 to 63,
at
WLOU. Yeah. What were you doing there?
News director. It was just a one-man show. And that was me.
And what part of your news directing was spent on the civil rights, area of civil rights?
Well, I think it was sort of winding down then, I guess, around, not winding down, but it was pretty much the same thing, you know, just covering the demonstrations and whatnot and reporting them. And of course...
So you were making the decisions and reporting it, WLOU?
Because we didn't have anyone else. It was just me, one-man news department. And, of course, it was... Because I sort of liked that better, but it wasn't as challenging, but... I liked it better because of the immediacy. You know, you could go out and cover something, come back and get it on the radio immediately. You didn't have to wait for publication, in this case in Defender, for a week. Mm-hmm. Or even, you know, you could even beat the dailies, you know, out with, you know, whatever information that you had. So I found that, you know, exciting to do that. So I did that in about 3 years.
Mm-hmm. And then, yeah, go ahead. Mm-hmm.
No, in fact, I was at LOU when we went to the March on Washington in 63.
Did you go to that?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, we caught a train out of Union Station and took that long journey up to D.C.
And the train didn't go directly to, did it go directly to D.C.?
Well, I had stops. I know it stopped in Ashland, but after that I'm a little hazy, but I remember it went, the reason I remember Ashland, because one of the young kids that was with us, we had to hold up the train a little bit because she went somewhere and came back late, so, you know, but that's the reason I remember Ashland.
But you didn't have to change trains, you just...
No, was, we were on the same train, yeah.
It was direct. Well, how did you coordinate with everybody else that was going on the march, or did you simply, were you a lone operator as a reporter?
Oh, no, we just went with the group, you know, went with the group, and as a reporter. But we were just in the group, and because if you're going to report on something like that, you have to be with them, you know, in order to talk to the people who are participating, you know, and when you get their insights and that sort of thing, which is what I did.
So you would have been talking to people on the train going to the march. What were they anticipating, and were their anticipations borne out?
Yeah, I think they were. They were excited, you know. They had a sense of history, you know, and it turned out that it was. You know, they were participating in something, you know, great, and they wanted to be a part of it, you know, to... Because there was quite a bit of, I guess, for want of another word, you know, hype about the March on Washington before that. And, you know, the kids were excited, and the adults were, too, because a lot of adults came along as chaperones, and, you know, and parents came with some of their children, etc. So it was, you know, it was nice. It was a time for people to get together and, you know, go as a family, and some people did.
Yeah. So the age range was two generations?
Yeah.
I mean...
Maybe three.
Teenage up,
yeah.
Pretty far up.
Yeah, up into the 60s, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Were there any whites on the train?
You know, I don't remember. I really don't remember, but it must have been, but I honestly really don't remember. But there must have been. But I don't recall. Kind of thing. I'm almost sure they were.
All right, you were on a public accommodation, right? And it's mm-hmm. 1963.
Mm-hmm.
How did that work?
Oh,
no public accommodations law.
Well, you know, they had a...
Was it a special train?
Don't recall, but I remember we didn't change trains, didn't change any coaches or anything of that sort. That I do remember. But it wasn't anything special that I recall, because I wasn't in on the arrangements, et cetera, so something could have been arranged before that. But somehow I sort of doubt it, because it seemed like it may have been more of a ruckus if it had been.
Do you remember any other reporters that were on that train with you?
No. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to remember whether any white reporters went up or not. Somebody from the Defender came. No, it wasn't a reporter. They sent a photographer, that's what it was. Probably Emma Thomas Washington, who's mm-hmm. deceased now.
All right, and when you got there, what happened?
Well, it was exciting, you know, because like the kids, many of the kids hadn't been to the Capitol before. We came in the Union Station, which didn't look like anything like it looks now. We came in Union Station in Washington, and we got off, and you know, and it wasn't that far, you know, from the area where we were going, as you know, in downtown Washington, you can walk wherever you're going. So anyway, there was a mass of people, you know, coming in on trains and whatnot. And everybody was excited about getting together, and especially the masses of people, you know, that were there.
In the station?
Yeah, and
outside.
And
beyond.
Yeah, mm-hmm. and outside. But they were getting together, you know, for the march and demonstration. And, you know, see people from different places, I guess, really excited, especially the kids. They're really excited, and, you know, other young people from everywhere and whatnot. And so it was a lot of excitement and anticipation.
Do you have a sense that it was well organized or chaotic
mm-hmm.
or what?
That was well organized, yeah. No problem. Everything went off like it was supposed to. It was a little long, but that's the way marches and demonstrations are, you know, and it was hot that day.
Did you march from the station?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. To the, was it the Capitol? I can't remember.
No,
Washington
Lincoln
Monument?
Memorial.
Lincoln, of course.
Yeah.
Lincoln Memorial.
Yeah, it was quite a distance, but, you know, I said, well, young people, I was younger at that time, so I didn't think much about it either. In fact, I've walked that distance before, since then. In fact, I did a couple of years ago. We had a family reunion in D.C. and took some friends. We were over in Arlington. And so I took some friends. We went to Georgetown, and we were at Foggy Bottom. So I said, well, let's go to the mall, you know. So it was just a short distance. So we went down 23rd Street past the State Department. And, you know, around to the Lincoln Memorial, started at the top of the mall, and we started walking and talking, going by the Smithsonian and all that, all the way down to the Capitol, which is right across from the train station, so to speak. And someone said, I don't believe I did that. That's a pretty long walk. But anyway, it was nice. It was exciting. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And do you remember anything, I mean, we've all seen news clips of King's mm-hmm. speech and everything, but, I mean, do you have anything to add about about that, about its effect, or?
Well, it was. Well, I remember as anytime you look at a speech from Martin Luther King, you see these, you know, swells, you know, and people, you know, applauding and et cetera. But in this case, when he started with this "I Have a Dream" thing, it was sort of like building like a crescendo, you know. It was just building and building and building and building. And as you know, so he really has a knack, you know, tying in scripture with the situation of the day, of the speech of the day. And it was just excitement. It, you know, each little time he said, "I have a dream," you know, and all this, you know, just, you know, claps and yays, and it was exciting. It was for everybody. Yeah.
How do you, or how did you, I should say, how were you able to maintain a reporter's objectivity while being at an event like this?
Well, I don't know. I guess, you know, when you've been in the news business, I hadn't been in that long, maybe about 7 years at that time, but still, you know, there's a certain amount of objectivity that comes with the job, I guess. You know, you may think differently inside, but at least your demeanor, you know, doesn't change that much. And I guess in your outside demeanor sometimes takes over your inside, the way you view things, although you know what's happening and how key it is and how exciting it might be. And you, like I'm telling you now, it was exciting. And it was exciting to me at that time, but at the same time, you know, I knew I was there to chronicle the event, so to speak, and to write about it. And to write about it in such a way to reflect that excitement. And I guess you sort of feel it through that, you know, as you write, you know, that excitement sort of, you know, comes through in what you write. But, yeah, it's exciting, and you know, but you have to keep your wits about you and go ahead and do the job. And it's not as hard as you might think, you know, especially it's fairly easy, you know, to do that. Because if you don't, you know, you sort of lose sight on what you're doing.
Well, you were at WLOU at this time, you said, during March. Now, did you do straight reporting at WLOU, or did you ever do editorial comment?
No, straight reporting. Okay. No, I don't think they did editorial comments at that time. I'm trying to think whether they did or not. I don't think so. I know I didn't do them, so.
Well, back to the march for just a minute. Mm-hmm. Did you, after the march and the speech, or the speeches, mm-hmm. Did you turn around, get back on the train, and go home?
Yeah.
Or didn't stay?
No. Mm-hmm. Came back with the same group. Mm-hmm. Everybody went back to the station and got back on the train.
And you would have talked to people on the train going back?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And do you remember any particular unusual insights on the return trip?
No, I guess everybody was still enthused and really had a, you know, high, you know, from the speeches and whatnot. And it was a lot of laughing and joking, and a lot of people were just tired, you know, after that, and a lot of them just went to sleep. You know, maybe by the time we got to Western Maryland, I think everybody was probably just tuckered out. You know, as I said before, it was a hot day, and it was a pretty long walk, you know, so it was kind of tiring, to say the least.
All right, and then soon after that, you then went back to the Defender.
Mm-hmm.
And how about editorial comment there? You were a reporter.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But were you in on any of the decision-making at the Louisville Defender?
No.
In other words, decisions about what kind of a stand to take or approach to take or any of that stuff?
No, you know, actually in black newspapers, I guess it was maybe understood to everybody what kind of stand you're going to take. And we never had any conferences about this sort of thing.
But there's just degrees and there's ways to say things and that kind of thing.
Yeah. But you know, Frank Stanley Sr., who did the editorial writing, and people who worked there, including me, I don't think there's, you know, there was always a meeting of the minds. Nothing could be, you know, of course, the news columns were separate, as they, you know, are in most newspapers from the editorial side. Mm-hmm. But his, you know, his stand, and so far as civil rights was concerned, was very strong from the beginning. And that was fine with me and everybody else that worked there. It was never, you know, like it was almost unsaid. It was understood.
Right, and so I mean, I assume that too.
Yeah.
But I think what I'm trying to get at is, you know, there are lots of ways to say the same thing. And I guess the question would be, you know, how I don't want to use the word shrill because that's, you know, how, you know, whether to say something sort of calmly or whether to say something with force or, I guess that's what I'm talking at. I've been talking about.
Well, Frank Stanley would come out and talk to me and maybe Nathaniel Tillman, who was still there, who was the managing editor. But it was, you know, mostly he just maybe ask us about what we think about this or that. But he was probably, you know, as emphatic as anyone would want to be, because you have to remember that Frank Stanley had done a lot of work, you know, in promoting civil rights, even in, I think he was appointed, for example, as a special counsel for the War Department during the war to go overseas and check about, you know, accommodations for black soldiers and whether they're being involved in the war effort or whether they're just back, you know, packing crates and whatnot, supplies for the troops and whatnot. And he did that, and then he was, I think he's one of the first members of the Kentucky Commission on Civil Rights. In fact, he was chairman, and I think he was vice chairman, I don't know whether he was chairman or not, and he was instrumental in drafting that the state law that created the commission. I think that was in 63. Is that 63? Somewhere along that. But anyway, he's always been in the forefront, and very, you know, gung-ho on civil rights, which is what, I don't know whether that answers your question or not, but it really it sort of gets to it in a way that he was always out front on things like that, which was fine with us. You know, so
Right, and I'm sure you think that I'm asking a sort of an obvious question, but I guess what I'm getting at is this, that there was a certain, if I'm correct, at least among some of the white press, there was a certain tenor that this is right, but go a little bit slow, or you're going to end up in a worse situation than you were. And I mean, you can make all kinds of accusations at that particular stand. I mean, either that's really what they meant, or you can say, well, that's racism in disguise. I mean, so I guess I'm thinking more in terms of strategizing as to you know, what is the most effective way to go. But I think what you're telling me is, go for it.
Oh yeah,
and that
was
the,
that's the way it was. Yeah. Now there was it was full speed ahead. You know. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now there was never any doubt, any discussions, anything of that sort. And you know, never. You know, nobody even in thought in any other. You know, as you flash back on the situation, as I think back, I think it was sort of a. Yeah, most of the time in the black community, people seem to think that it's, you know, they think alike, but it's not true. But in this case, I think the black community was united, you know, in one effort.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Then in 1967, you went to the Courier Journal.
Right.
Now, how did that come about?
Well, I'd went over. And had applied in 1966, I think it was. And spoke from the Urban League, my name is Earl Johnson, who suggested that I apply. I hadn't even thought about it, but he suggested that I apply. So I did in 66. And then I think it was about that time when Martin Luther King was here for the open housing demonstration. They were talking about this possible demonstration at Churchill Downs in 66, early 67. Anyway, it was about that time that they called me in for an interview. And I guess they needed someone right away because I went in and they took me immediately up to Bob Clark, who was the managing editor at the time of the Times, and asked me, you know, would I accept the job? I said, well, so maybe I'll talk to the city editor. I think he said, well, it doesn't make any difference to the city editor. So I said, I was a little shocked, you know, but when he said that, you know. But anyway, Norman Isaacs was the executive editor at that time, who died about 4 or 5 years ago.
May have been too long. But anyway, apparently the decision had been made that you know, they need some more black reporters, because they only had one at that time in the Courier, nobody on the Times. And I guess they saw this, you know, demonstrations coming to a head, because as you remember, in 66 and 65, I think the riots had broken out in Detroit and California and Los Angeles and someplace else in the late 60s. So they figured that something like that might happen, and it did in 68, although we call it a mini-riot. It wasn't much of a riot.
But, you mean here?
Yeah, here, yeah, in 68, down on 28th Street, which really shouldn't have happened. The things just got, you know, somebody got excited and too much of a show of force, which I was kind of nervous about this past Derby Day, when they talked about all the police being down there, you know, and given the climate. So he needed a little spark, and, you know, and you got something big down there with that, you know, that. But I think the ambassador's helped, but I think the Justice Department, when they came up with that idea, I think somebody must have contacted them here, the U.S. Justice Department, because they had used ambassadors in other places, that is, community people.
Oh, you're talking about this year?
Yeah, this year.
Okay,
yeah.
Okay.
And sort of diffuse things a little bit. But anyway, that's, I guess they were afraid that something like that might happen, so they decided they needed some more black reporters. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I came up one day and was hired the same day.
All right, let's go back to that part. Mm-hmm. Why did you decide to leave the Defender and go to the Courier-Journal? Why did you apply in 66?
Well, as I said before, the fellow at Urban League, the name was Earl Johnson, had asked me to, because he was trying mm-hmm. to place, you know, some black reporters over there. And so I said, okay, I didn't think anything about it, so I went over and applied.
And it was important to him to have black mm-hmm. reporters at the Courier-Journal.
Yeah. Well, yeah, as you recall, Urban League, that's what they do. Not only they tried to, you know, place black people in non-traditional jobs at that time that black people did not have, you know, such as even secretaries of different places and reporters, you know, professional and non-professional and non-traditional jobs where there had not been any. Because as you might recall, I think back in, I think as late as the late 50s, you know, even in the classifieds, they used to have, you know, the ads, employment ads, used to specify white only and that sort of thing. It hadn't been that long ago, either in the 60s or something like that. So anyway, the Urban League was trying to, you know, do something to put a dent in that. So they were trying to get people to apply for different jobs all over. And Earl was trying, that was part of that. He was the, I forgot what they call it, I guess he was the assistant secretary for something. I forgot what it was. But anyway, that was his job. That was, to put people in these positions. And that's when he asked me. So I said, okay, but about 6 or 9 months later, almost a year later, I guess, before they called me.
Mm-hmm. And what did you find when you got there?
Oh.
How was it moving into the atmosphere of essentially a white publication?
Oh, it was fine. A lot of people that I knew, you know, previously, and like Bill Woosley and Leonard Pardew and who else? And some more folks. I think there was a couple more. And the guys on the police beat I'd met, too, at that time. And so it was, you know, it was very friendly. And Bob Crump, that was the city editor, and he's a great guy, and wasn't any problem at all.
And how was it, I mean, did you have to learn anything that you didn't already know from working at the Defender? Or were there any different, you know, rules or methods or approaches?
No, I was just getting used to those, you know, fast deadlines and the times. And we used to start at 7 o'clock, and as I recall, the first deadline was for Tuesday, I think it was about 5 minutes to 8, about an hour. If you had to do something, you had to do about an hour. And then I think the Indiana edition deadline, because I was involved in that, that was about 8:30, and then the final deadline was 9 o'clock. So you had about three deadlines, like right in a row, so if you had to do something, you had to do it pretty darn fast. And yeah, that, of course, working with a weekly, you know, you didn't have to do it, though. You sort of leisurely put together, so, you know, sort of thing. But of course, you had a lot of help, because you had copy editors and whatnot. And that Defender, we didn't have that luxury. You didn't have a lot of copy editors and that sort of thing. And then you had people like Joe Landau, who was a slot man. I don't know whether you remember him. Used to be that's the guy that sits in an old-fashioned, if you see a photograph in an old-fashioned newsroom, it's just sort of a semicircle, and copy editor sitting around, and you had one guy in the middle, sort of chief copy editor, a slot man. But anyway, Joe Landau was the chief copy editor. He was a nice guy. I remember he had, I think it was about two or three photos came about the same time I did, and he said I was out to his house for dinner and that sort of thing. And a lot of people left, like Eric Pianin, who's with the Washington Post now, and a lot of folks used to come out to Joe's. He'd like to gather in people that were coming in and take them out to his house. And the baby would just do the same thing. Yeah, yeah. Remember right after I came, he had a big soiree out in Glenview, and he had all the new reporters out and whatnot. And had, bad employers going around, playing and... And I spread, and it was fun. So anyway, reception was great. Couldn't be that.
And there was, as you indicated, that there was nothing, except for the fast deadlines, there was nothing all that different about the job.
No, reporting, just did reporting like I did always. In fact, I started, I did some civil rights, but mostly I was doing education and social issues when I started.
My impression is that's not why they hired you.
No, but they wanted to, I guess they didn't want to make it that blatant. So anyway, the funny thing happened. I was doing social issues and education, and then about 6 months after I was there, I fell in with David Diaz, he's Puerto Rican, great guy, I never went back to New York. But anyway, he came to town and he started covering civil rights. In fact, he covered the... That's when it broke out.
Oh, he did. So, you have any idea how that happened? Why David Diaz?
Well, I don't know why he did that. I guess it maybe because, David Diaz was a Puerto Rican, and he was, dark. And David always says, he says, I may not be black, but I'm not white either. Maybe the same, a lot of Latins would say, that there's a lot of mixed Indian and African and... whatever else, that's... He said, it's a black boy in my bag. I don't know exactly where I'm going, but it's there.
Does that mean that he and not you covered the 1968
demonstrations? Yeah, I did some of the, some late work down there, but he did most of the coverage. Because I was living at 20, down here over Nolly at the time, which maybe about them. I guess maybe around about 8 or 9 bucks.
This is where and all, did you say?
Yeah, he had that on his little house down the corner. Mm-hmm. At that time. And that was only about 7 or 8 bucks, I guess, from wherever. But, I was home. I didn't know anything about that. That was the news. And then the next day, because I think they had out of luck before that, because I met him there, but I was spending money. He wasn't reporting. He was here at that time. And Nathaniel Tillman, who was second with me, had come over as a copy editor at the Times. But that guy out there, I think they're annoying. I know he had a break, but I had a sense, I had a film with him. And he was working, and he had family, he had several kids. And he was working two jobs, he really supported his family, so he took a job at the post office. So I thought about him, and he had the opportunity, and I said, well, I could record it, I was just, that's what he did. The pay was better. Oh, yeah.
Let me just run out this tape. I have to cut you off in mid-paragraph.
Okay, so at some point after the riot started, the Times sent all of their black reporters down. Mm-hmm. Now, before that happened, you said you lived 7 or 8 blocks from the area. Did you hunker down in your house, or did you go out to see what was going on?
No, I knew better than that. I stayed home. as I said, it was late anyway when I heard about it. I guess it was on the late news, about 11 o'clock. And I did hear, something... some noise or something like that, but, I didn't think too much about it, but I turned on the news about 11 o'clock and it said some disturbances had broken out. Because I think the disturbance must have started around about after the speech by a fellow named Cortez, I forget his first name. I think he was from out of town, and then things just got out of hand.
And did you stay up listening to the radio?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Was there, 1968, was there anything on television?
I don't recall. I don't think so. I think it was just some voice over. I don't think there was any tape. The news was on, but I don't think it was any tape. I'm almost sure it wasn't any tape.
But
any film, yeah.
But as you listened to the radio, did you have a sense of things developing? I mean, did you know it was getting bad?
Well,
that
I
first
had a hunch,
night?
Yeah, I had a hunch that it might, you know, because of what had happened in other places, you know, in other cities, and the fact that people in law enforcement, I think, probably were a little jittery, you know, and usually when you get a combination of jittery law enforcement people and folks that feel like they've been wrong about law enforcement, it's a bad combination, you know, usually things happen that are not good. Mm-hmm. But I didn't think it was going to be too much to it. In reality, I thought maybe it might be a little light disturbance or something like that. And it wasn't really a big, big thing like it was in Detroit and Watts and, you know, places like that, mm-hmm. which you had, you know, entire blocks and blocks and blocks. But this thing really just happened between, maybe just a block and a half area, just between Dumanil and Virginia, and maybe parts of Dumanil, some places down through there. Mm. And of course the 28th and 28th, well, it started the 28th and Greenwood, but nothing happened right there, because actually there was mostly residential right at that area. Just had a couple of restaurants on that corner and a store, and then they moved about three blocks south of there. No, yeah, about three blocks south of there, down to Virginia, where the little shopping area is, and still is, you know, right now. But it wasn't really that big.
and you said it shouldn't have happened. Why did it happen?
I don't know. I think it was just, you know, maybe you just had some, excuse me, some people like this guy Cortez that came in from out of town, and there was a push for, you know, for more civil rights, you know, maybe, you know, jobs and fairness and that sort of thing. And I think that maybe people got riled up and something happened, and people thought that things were going to get out of hand, and they did, after law enforcement came in. I think what they really thought was, I think what sort of exacerbated the situation was when something happens and then you get a police presence or something like that, and people start resenting the police presence, and the police feel like they have to do something, you know, to keep things under control, and then things get out of hand. But I wasn't there at the time, so I really don't know, but I just suspect that that's probably what happened. You know?
And it seems to me that 1968 was before there had been much training in riot control or in keeping the passions down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that still is this today. Yeah, and I say, you know, just like they had the ambassadors, you know, they had black community folks out and trying to keep things down. Most of the situations that escalate between police and black people, I think, is just a matter. It happens to white folks too, you know, especially if. Sometimes the perception is, you know, especially in terms of police, that people are powerless. You know, I hate to phrase it that way, but I think it is. They react differently with white folks in Portland than they do with white folks in Prospect. And the same thing, they react differently with black folks in Prospect than they do with black folks in the Russell area. And I think it's the sense of that maybe if we do something to somebody here, you know, they, you know, have some recourse and we might be in trouble. But I think it's a lack of respect sometimes for people who they think, you know, don't have any power, connections or something of that sort. And, you know, and you can, you know, if I'm downtown or something like that, dressed differently, and they stop me, you know, and I ask a simple question, why are you stopping me? I'm sort of getting an insult. You know, it's the truth. And that's always been the case. And then when you insult somebody, you know, your response in many instances is insult back. You know, before you know it, you know, things have escalated, and you know, and it's just terrible. You know, sometimes it's a lack of respect, and I think in police community, in community policing, for example, you know, when police are really connected to the communities, and whether they be black or white, you know, and if you just get that lack of respect. People are nearly not crazy. They're not going to challenge police, somebody with a gun in their hand, you know, something like that, unless they're crazy. But sometimes when you treat people badly, then they start, you know, reacting badly, and you have those situations. And, you know, it's not paranoia. You can scratch any black person's back that's over 25 or 30 or younger, and they can probably, recall some incident, you know, some bad incident with police if they've had one. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So it's.
And did you ever see? Well, let me get back to 1968 for just a minute. You listened to it on the radio, and then was it the next day? When did the paper dispatch all of the black journalists?
Oh, the next day.
Next day. Mm-hmm. And where precisely did you go?
Around 28th Street and...
That same corner?
Yeah, around 28th Street and Greenwood, and then up to Duvernail. Around up that way, just to observe mostly, and talk to some people that were there and just ask them what went on. And most of the time, not too many people knew what was going on. Because just really a small amount of people were at that rally at 28th Street, and it started to disperse. And as I said earlier, it was mostly a residential area, and I guess people really just stayed in. I think it was mostly maybe a younger crowd that was there. But I don't think it was too many people in the community that were there.
Was it beginning to calm down by the next day?
No, I think it went on for about 2 or 3 days, I think. I'm a little fuzzy on that, but I think it was at least about 2 or 3 days.
Did you ever see, in this particular demonstration, did you ever see any of that, any of that kind of behavior between the police and the black citizens?
No, I didn't.
Not at that particular time.
No, as I said before, I wasn't a primary reporter on that. David Diaz was, and he was down, you know, mostly covering when it was sort of dicey. I think he was there most of the time then. And I think it was just probably the usual thing, just crowd control, you know, moving people on and so forth. And I think most of the things that died down were just some sporadic incidents, I think, after that. No, I didn't witness anything like that at that time.
Do you remember what happened after that? I mean, after this particular disturbance calmed down?
Well, I think there were meetings between black community leaders and I think Frank Stanley Jr. was probably involved, and I think Reverend Sampson, maybe Bishop Tucker, and I think Frank Stanley Sr. and maybe Reverend W.J. Hodge, I think, was maybe NAACP president at that time. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure about that. And community leaders just trying to find some solutions and et cetera. But other than that, you know, then things just sort of quieted down, you know, on their own. And then there were other things going on. I think the Louisville and Jefferson County Community Action Agency, for example, they had been set up to try to poor people, start their poor people's campaign. It started part of the war on poverty. It was, trying to get several programs, you know, off the ground, and some of it alleviates somewhat with some poverty conditions in some parts of Western Louisville and that sort of thing. So I guess there's a lot of things going on to sort of calm the situation at that time.
Now, there had been a public accommodations law passed in Kentucky in 1966. It was after the Voting Rights Act of 1964, the national one. But the Public Accommodations Act had been passed. So these 1968 disturbances were about general conditions?
Yeah, general conditions, I think. Yeah, mostly. And I guess just the general feeling of being left out of, you know, of the good life, so to speak. Mm-hmm. You know, and as you know, and even when things are better, you know, and employment, for example, employment statistics, I think it's the unemployment rate is about 8 or 9 or 10% is usually around about maybe 20% of the black community, and things like that. There was still a lot of, you know, unemployment and a little unrest over that. And then again, there was, but I don't know whether they entered into it, but there still was a matter of housing, et cetera. And there had been some, but I don't think people that were supporting open housing were out there rising. This is mostly a younger group. And just general dissatisfaction, I think. And I think at that time, too, I think there was an issue with police that they were dissatisfied about, even at that time. So that's been going on for a long time.
And as you say, of course, the housing was,
yeah,
was a lot of that.
Do you remember whether the inequalities of people being sent to Vietnam entered into any of these?
I don't think so.
Okay.
But I'm trying to search my mind, and I'm trying to recall whether or not, let me think. I'm trying to remember, Martin Luther King was assassinated in April of 68. Mm-hmm. When you said something may have sparked those disturbances, I'm trying to figure out whether or not that came after, well, that may have been part of it. Maybe Martin Luther King's assassination may have been part of it. That was in April of 68. And disturbances broke out in 68. It was warm. I think it must have been after April.
Summer.
Yeah. So I think that may have sparked some of that.
And of course, Robert Kennedy was shot that summer.
Yeah, that summer. Yeah, in 68.
And as you say, there were, I mean, 68 was a bad year, and the cities were burning. And
yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it may have something to do with it. I remember, because later on in 68, we went on the Poor People's Campaign, and that's when A.D. Williams King, Martin Luther King's brother, was passed at Zion Baptist Church down at 22nd and Muhammad Ali.
Now that was something separate?
Poor People's Campaign?
Uh-huh.
Oh yeah, that was quite an event. Yeah, Martin Luther King had started organizing this and before he died, before he was assassinated. And what it was to take this mass of people to Washington for a demonstration for jobs and opportunities and economic. It was also an economic demonstration, but anyway, you had this massive flow of people and buses, and I joined, and Tom Hardin, who I think he went to Detroit News as a photographer. Anyway, I went for the Times, and Tom Hardin was the photographer. Curiously or not, the Courier didn't send anybody, but the Times did. So we joined the campaign when he came here. It was part of the Midwest Party campaign, which originated, I think, in Milwaukee and came through Chicago and picked up people in Chicago through Gary in Annapolis and picked up people there. By the time they got here, I think it must have been 10 Greyhound buses of folks. I think they left there. It must have been about five more. It must have been about 15, so you can imagine that the big buses going up to Cincinnati. And it came out for
Now, I'm a little confused.
Yeah.
You said there was the Midwest part,
mm-hmm,
and all these buses. Now, were they doing their demonstrating in the Midwest, or were they picking people
up
and taking them to Washington?
Picking people up and taking them to Washington.
Okay.
And this was going on all parts. You know, there was people coming up from the South, people coming up from California, because they had Native Americans and also Chicanos and from Southwest in California, and it was and white folks, from Appalachia and now those places, and that was really quite a sight, because I remember we came through here and we went to Cincinnati and stayed overnight in Cincinnati, and people took so many people in their homes overnight, and first time I'd seen Jesse Jackson, because he spoke at the cathedral in 68.
In Cincinnati?
Mm-hmm. At Episcopal Cathedral. And they had people on the caravan. Again, this is still the Midwest caravan. And he spoke to people there. And big afro, as I recall. About this big. And
Was he much the same as a speaker
then as
he is now?
Yeah, because he was much younger, and people were saying, "Well, who is he?" Somebody said, "Yeah, he's quite a speaker," things like that. But anyway, and then we left there and went to Dayton, picked up some more folks, went to Detroit,
and picked up a big group there. And I think we stayed overnight in Troy. Yeah, stayed overnight in Troy. Because I remember we came down in front of the Colo Hall, I think it was, because I saw some people from here that came down, because there was a demonstration there too. A lot of these towns, when they came through, there was a little rally, you know, something like that. And so we stayed there. And then we left and went back through Toledo onto I think it was Canton. And then from there, anyway, we went from there to Pittsburgh. And they were everybody was tired, really tired. By the time they got to Pittsburgh, and we checked into, Tom and I checked into a hotel. I felt a little guilty about that, but that was that. So Tom and I checked into a hotel, and the people stayed in the arena in downtown Pittsburgh, right across from the Hyatt. I think it's the Howard Johnson's now, across from the Hyatt. And it's a funny thing, because I don't know whether it was the Pittsburgh Gazette or which one it was, but they just thought that we were going to come in town and move on, like they usually do. But people became ill. You know, I think some intestinal flu or something like that. But anyway, they stayed there 2 days. But they ran a headline that said the Poor People's Campaign came to town and left. And of course, that wasn't true. They just said, you know, I guess something like that headline, was it Dewey and defeated by Dewey defeats Truman and one of those. But that was really strange. But anyway, we finally got to D.C. about, I guess in about 6 or 7 days or something like that. But, and then, you know, they had these tents out on the mall. And why not?
Let me just interrupt you a minute and ask you, why did they take the circuitous route through the Midwest in order to drum up enthusiasm and drama and all this kind of thing?
Well, probably.
I mean, couldn't they have just had a different bus in each city and going straight to Washington?
Yeah, they could have, but you would miss all the drama and, you know, out of the...
So the point was a caravan. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, you have to remember too that you had these caravans coming from everywhere, up to, from the south and from the west and east, you know, and all over, just converging on Washington. And it was quite a sight. So they had these tents out on the mall and whatnot and that sort of thing. And they had the demonstrations and they talked about cutting Martin Luther and did. I think they had a conference with some federal officials. I don't remember how they went to the White House and that. At that time, 68, I guess, would have been. He was president then, 68.
Well,
was it Carter?
Well, no, Johnson was finishing up.
Yeah, that's right, because he didn't...
He wasn't running again.
Yeah, he wasn't running again. I guess he was still in, though, at that time, mm-hmm. Was it, in 68, yeah. Yeah, because, yeah, I guess Johnson was... But I don't think he went to the White House at that time. Seems like maybe I remember the president saying something or another, though. But,
Well, who took the helm? Who were the...
The leaders?
I'm having trouble remembering this.
The leaders of the...
Yeah, well, took over from King.
Yeah,
for those
it was Ralph Abernathy.
Yeah,
and Jesse was there, Ralph Abernathy and Jesse Jackson. The main mind folks like Roy Wilkins, who was president of the NAACP at that time, wasn't involved. I don't think Vinnie Young Jr. was either. If he was, I don't recall him being around. But it was mostly Southern Christian Leadership Conference folks. Mm-hmm. Oh, Andrew Young. I forgot about Andrew Young. He was sort of the brain thrust of all of that. And it was mostly Andrew Young, Ralph Abernathy, and Jesse Jackson. And Iggy Williams King played a fairly large role in the King's brother. There's no doubt. But about, this has been good about 10 years now, no more.
Is there a way to compare these two, Martha and Washington? The Poor People's Campaign and D. March on Washington?
Well, I think people, you know, remember D. March on Washington. I guess it's because of Martin Luther King's speech, but they may remember the other one even more if he'd been alive, possibly. Because there was, you know, well, the other one was serious, too, but this was a bread and butter kind of thing, you know, that involved a mass of people. And a mass of people that, I don't want to say got disenfranchised, but a lot of them were, you know, that was there. And they were a lot of genuinely poor people. It wasn't a catchphrase. A lot of these folks were just genuinely poor people. Yeah, they came on that campaign.
Well, would you characterize, at least the second campaign, would you characterize it more as one of anger, frustration, hope,
Well, I think it was one of hope and frustration. I don't think people really that angry, but I think they wanted to do something about their situation and the situation that people like them. Mm-hmm. That was sort of, despite the promises of the war on poverty, still languishing, and their lives are not better. And that's what Martin Luther King, saw in the Reason for the Poor People campaign, is to bring bring national attention, make it serve these caravans, and well, that do that. And the city that you went through, you had to realize what was going on, because he wasn't gonna do that. you get this massive show. I think at one time it must have been about 20 or 25 buses going through these towns, and you have to have a police presence out there to clear the highways and whatnot and stuttering and traffic jams. So the mere presence of these buses and sort of crystallized things in the minds of most people while they were there, what they were doing and what the purpose was. But as I said before, the 63 campaign had more of an impact because that was mostly by Martin Luther King. The Poor People's campaign didn't have that much of an impact so far as being noticed by a lot of people. Mm-hmm. Because he wasn't there, and whether what they did was important, but it wasn't much of a lasting impact on the minds of people after that.
Well, your family is obviously alive, so we need to wind this down, and I'll just ask you if there's anything else that you remember being engaged in as a reporter in the civil rights line, say, immediately after 1968, or anything we might have missed.
No, kind of thing. It was after I got started covering religion, and of course, there's a lot of things going on there, but I covered religion for about 10 or 12 years. And of course, with the Southern Baptist fit and whatnot, I think that was hard going, I guess, for a lot of people.
But that was after this period that we're talking about,
right? Mm-hmm.
Okay. Didn't overlap with
the I think it was before started in 1968. That's when the big change. I remember Dick McCall, who used to be the president of Southern Baptist, and I was somebody there telling me that. And Houston, I was connecting when I was talking to him. And that's when this guy, James Robinson, he still be a TV evangelist. Got up and started calling kind of the moderate and convincing, comparing them to snakes and lizards. And all this sort of thing. And so, Duke was calling, and I was taking him up to that sort of thing. So, that didn't ever get anywhere. So, no, they didn't know, huh?
And you have now gone with the black child.
I know.
And you've been with it for, 6 months, a year?
Yeah, about a year. Yeah.
And what made my father come about?
Well, I thought him for a minute. He had the idea to start the magazine. And he knew I was retired. That was last year. I guess it was before he died in March. And I said he needed some help. And I helped him get it started. And I said, okay, I'll volunteer. I don't really get any money for it. Just some expenses here right now. And hopefully, I guess maybe we might make some money somewhere down there. So I thought I was a volunteer. I was a volunteer. I was up to that kind of thing. So we put out a fairly decent magazine, considering that we don't have any single things that magazines usually have. We don't have an eye director, we don't have a photo, editor, we don't have we have one copy editor. That still works, part-time. Well, he doesn't work part-time, he just has some copy, I say, what's wrong with you, look at that. I don't think anything to do with me, and then we got a volunteer group with the same way, And the only people that really tell you is the graphic artist, and you full, what you might expect, but it's going great, that kind of thing.
I certainly thank you for your time. Bye, everyone.